Today is Friday, February 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Democratic House managers rest their impeachment case against former President Donald Trump.
Humbly ask you to convict President Trump for the crime for which he is overwhelmingly guilty of.
Plus, more governments are taking action against Myanmar's military junta.
The military coup and government takeover isn't to be tolerated.
And conserving wildlife and lands in Africa. We'll have these stories and more next. House Democrats prosecuting former President Donald Trump's impeachment have wrapped up their opening arguments. Representative Joe Neguse implored the senator serving as a jury in the trial to seriously consider the evidence presented so far this week for Trump's conviction. This as they prepare to hear from the defense and ultimately deliberate the case.
Now, as you consider that question of whether the president incited an insurrection, there are three questions that reasonably come to mind. Was violence foreseeable? Did he encourage violence? And did he act willfully? And I'm going to show you why the answer to every one of those questions has to be yes.
He went on to say that acquitting Trump would have lasting effects.
Humbly ask you to convict President Trump for the crime for which he is overwhelmingly guilty of. Because if you don't, if we pretend this didn't happen, or worse, if we let it go unanswered, who's to say it won't happen again?
It was lead manager Representative Jamie Raskin who rested the House's case and spoke directly to Trump's defense team, asking a series of questions.
One, why did President Trump not tell his supporters to stop the attack on the Capitol as soon as he learned of it? Why did President Trump do nothing to stop the attack for at least 2 hours after the attack began? As our constitutional commander-in-chief, why did he do nothing to send help to our overwhelmed and besieged law enforcement officers for at least 2 hours on January 16th after the attack began? On January 6th, why did President Trump not at any point that day condemn the violent insurrection and the insurrectionists? And I'll add a legal question that I hope his distinguished counsel will address. If a president did invite a violent insurrection against our government, as of course we allege and think we've proven in this case, but just in general, if a president incited a violent insurrection against our government, would that be a high crime and misdemeanor?
For more on the day's events, I spoke with VOA executive producer Steve Reddish.
Today was all about former President Donald Trump. From various perspectives, the impeachment managers were very detailed in trying to show how Trump's imprint was on the attack. They used the former president's statements and tweets going back through his presidency and even before that when he was just a candidate to show how he condoned violence and supported those who occupied the Capitol building in Michigan. It was a big story during the early days of the pandemic when the Michigan governor put in a lockdown order, and all of these different militias went to the Capitol and occupied it. Well, the impeachment managers tried to draw a line from that and President Trump's support of that to the Capitol attack. One impeachment manager focused on what Trump tweeted and said after the attack began and explored what he called the former president's lack of remorse and lack of effort to stop the attack.
Now that the House managers have concluded making their arguments, it's now time for the former president's defense team to make theirs. Now, they have up to 16 hours to make their arguments. What do we know about the case that they will make on behalf of former President Donald Trump?
From the votes that were taken on whether or not this impeachment trial was constitutional, one can take from that that there are already enough Republican senators who to vote against conviction, to vote for acquittal. It's a very high bar to get 67 out of 100 senators to agree with this, and the Democrats have 50, and they need 17 Republican senators. So from all indications, Trump's lawyers, starting on Friday, will try to make a case that this that the former president has already vacated and that this trial is unnecessary, even though that the impeachment constitutionality was settled. It doesn't seem that the Trump lawyers will be spending a whole lot of time, certainly not all 16 hours that are allotted to them, in trying to make the case for the former president.
Steve Reddish is an executive producer in the VOA newsroom. In related news, five alleged members of the far-right Proud Boys group have been accused by federal prosecutors of a criminal conspiracy in the deadly attack on the U.S. Capitol last month that sought to keep then-President Donald Trump in power. On Thursday, prosecutors also disclosed that members of the anti-government Oath Keepers group had plotted to have a quick reaction force staged outside Washington on January 6th, ready to fight hand-to-hand if ordered to do so by Trump. More than 200 people have been charged in the assault on Congress, which led to Trump's impeachment trial this week on a charge of inciting insurrection. Democratic prosecutors in the impeachment trial have laid out in detail how they said Trump laid the groundwork for the attack by falsely claiming the election had been marred by fraud and then calling on his supporters to fight like hell to stop the steal. Thursday saw further protests throughout Myanmar as thousands of majority Christian ethnic Karen also marked their national day with demonstrations in Yangon and elsewhere. The military also called for an end to protests and urged civil servants, many of whom have been absent since the coup, to return to work. In the United States, the Biden administration imposed sanctions on Myanmar's acting president and several other military officers and warned that there could be more economic punishment as Washington responds to the military coup. The U.S. Treasury Department says it has targeted eight people, including the defense minister and three companies in the jade and gem sector. It has also updated sanctions on the top two military officials, accusing them of playing a leading role in overthrowing Myanmar's democratically elected government. White House staff say that the sanctions imposed on Thursday do not need to be permanent. They're urging Myanmar's military to immediately restore power to the democratically elected government, end the state of emergency, release all those unjustly detained, and ensure peaceful protesters are not met with violence. New Zealand has also imposed a travel ban and cut ties with military leaders in Myanmar. Phil Mercer has that part of the story.
New Zealand has said it doesn't recognize the legitimacy of the military-led government in Myanmar. Army General seized power in the Southeast Asian nation, also known as Burma, earlier this month. Authorities in Wellington have called for the release of all detained political leaders and for restoration of civilian rule. The government is implementing a travel ban on Myanmar's military leaders. Wellington has said it will ensure its overseas aid program wouldn't include projects that would benefit Myanmar's military leaders. New Zealand Foreign Affairs Minister Nanaia Mahuta told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that strict measures were needed.
It sends a fairly clear message that the situation in Myanmar in terms of the military coup and government takeover isn't to be tolerated. Look, the people of Myanmar over the last 10 years have had two multi-party elections and a democratically designated government, and the transition to democracy hasn't been an easy pathway.
Hundreds of pro-democracy demonstrators gathered Tuesday outside the New Zealand Parliament, protesting the actions of Myanmar's military. Myanmar was controlled by a repressive military government from 1962 to 2011. The army still retained influence during the transition to democracy. The military seized control of the country last week, just hours before the country's second democratically elected parliament was due to start. Generals had alleged fraud in November's election. Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy party won a landslide victory with more than 80% of the vote. She's thought to be under house arrest along with other colleagues and aides. New Zealand has joined other countries calling for a special session at the United Nations Human Rights Council on Myanmar to consider the impact of the military takeover on human rights. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Women's rights groups in Mali are suing the government for not doing enough to protect girls from circumcision, which is also known as female genital mutilation or FGM. As Annie Reisenberg reports, activists say the case shows how difficult it is to change the practice in Mali.
Malian dancer Fatoumata Bagayoko is also an activist who speaks out against female circumcision, also named by the damage it causes, female genital mutilation, or FGM. The United Nations says Mali has the highest rate of FGM in West Africa. 83% of Malian women undergo the cultural practice, which is often forced on young girls. Bagayoko was a young infant when the procedure was performed on her, but she says it took a while to realize her trauma.
It was when I went to the village and I saw these little girls running around who were taken by force so that they would be cut, and the tears that these girls, the fear that they had, that I read on their faces. It was there that I understood.
Women's rights groups filed papers in December to sue the Malian government in the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, Court of Justice, for failing to stop FGM. The Malian Association for the Monitoring and Orientation of Traditional Practices, AMSOPT, is one of the plaintiffs.
We, who are the defenders of human rights, who defend women and children, we think that the state has the responsibility and the duty to protect these girls who didn't ask to be cut.
Mali's activists went to ECOWAS after decades of struggling against conservative religious leaders who blocked attempts to outlaw FGM. But the UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, says about a fifth of villages have agreed to stop FGM, and the lawsuit could open needed talks on banning it.
So we need to move the next stage to encourage leaders and communities to stand for that and obviously get the 80% missing. So that conversation and that exposure may help to do so.
Meanwhile, Bagayoko teaches dance as a way to connect with girls and raise awareness of FGM. She also visits villages and says she speaks to elders about the practice from a place of cultural understanding.
Every year, every era has its reality. When they did this, they had their reality at the time, but they didn't think of the consequences that this can pose.
The ECOWAS court has not yet set a date for hearing the case against Mali's government. A government spokesperson and the Ministry of Women and Children did not respond to requests for comment. Annie Reisenberg for VOA News, Bamako, Mali.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The World Health Organization says the Oxford-AstraZeneca coronavirus vaccine can save lives and recommends using it even in African countries where variant strains of COVID-19 are circulating. The WHO reports 3.7 million coronavirus infections, including nearly 100,000 deaths. Lisa Schlein takes it from here.
Since the first case of COVID-19 was identified in Africa nearly 1 year ago, the coronavirus, which causes the disease, has mutated. The continent now is faced with variant strains that are more dangerous and deadly. The World Health Organization says 8 countries have reported a highly contagious variant first found in South Africa, and 6 have seen another variant detected in Britain. In the wake of the mutations, South Africa said this week it would suspend use of the AstraZeneca vaccine because it is not effective in preventing mild and moderate infections. However, WHO Regional Director for Africa, Matshidiso Moeti, notes the vaccine appears to prevent severe cases of COVID-19 and hospitalization. Therefore, she says, its use would be a great boon to Africa's hospitals and healthcare systems, which are greatly overstretched.
If cases remain mostly mild and moderate and don't require critical care, then we can save many lives. So my message is to people, go out and get vaccinated when a vaccine becomes available in your country. ensuring equitable access to COVID-19 vaccines and sustaining the public health measures are the critical priorities to overcome this crisis.
The South African government has said it will continue to use the AstraZeneca vaccine under trial conditions among older healthcare workers to get better data on its impact on more severe forms of the disease. Meanwhile, Moiti says the international vaccine facility known as COVAX will begin a rollout of some 96 million doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine in Africa later this month. Moiti says the WHO is contacting governments to inform them about the recommendations issued by agency experts for use of the AstraZeneca vaccine.
An analysis of the risks and benefits with regard to using this vaccine needs to be made, and particularly to the neighboring countries, to South Africa, where the interaction is very intense, and we certainly know in several of those this variant is circulating. Well, of course, supporting and advising all the countries in the region.
Moiti also says the WHO was able to procure a small amount of Pfizer vaccine for distribution in four African countries. She says, though the quantities are small, they will provide those countries with experience on how to use the vaccine. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Optimism turned to panic as the European Union's vaccine rollout plunged into crisis after vaccine makers had to cut back deliveries. Reuters reporter Rosanna Pilpot explains why the EU's vaccine rollouts have been slow and fraught with problems compared to other countries, forcing the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen to acknowledge the failings this week.
Today is delivery day, and tomorrow vaccination against COVID-19 is beginning across the European Union.
This was President of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, delivering good news on the 26th of December. She hailed it as a touching moment of unity.
And a European success story.
But within a few weeks, the optimism had turned to confusion, anger, and panic as the EU's vaccine rollout was plunged into crisis.
I got, like many of you, the news today that Pfizer announced delays.
AstraZeneca told the EU on Friday it could not meet agreed supply targets to the end of March.
Vaccine rollouts in the European Union have been slow and fraught with problems compared with other countries.
The European Union asked AstraZeneca to divert supplies from the UK.
And now the companies must deliver. They must honour their obligations.
By the first week of February, the US had given first doses to 11% of its population, according to Our World in Data. Britain, almost 17%. While the EU countries put together just under 4. Why has the EU been so slow to vaccinate? The EU is making more comprehensive checks on vaccines before approval, which had already meant a slower rollout of shots than other countries, such as Britain, which opted to use emergency powers to speed up the process.
Give them away, Derek.
The European Union has decided against emergency approvals. We know that Great Britain has approved AstraZeneca within 24 hours. I think we did the right thing. It's about trust.
Then, in January, US drug maker Pfizer and Anglo-Swedish AstraZeneca both announced supply cuts to the EU. AstraZeneca cited production problems at its Brussels plant and a 60% fall in supply. There was an immediate public outcry across Europe.
Europe invested billions to help develop the world's first COVID-19 vaccines. And now the companies must deliver.
They are already using the vaccine in Great Britain, in other countries as well.
Not being able to ensure manufacturing capacity is against the letter and the spirit of our agreement.
AstraZeneca does also make vaccines in Germany and Britain, but the British factories became closed off because London was using a clause in its contract that gave it priority over doses made in the UK. Public data showed Britain, freshly divorced from the EU, was inoculating people at a much faster pace than any EU country.
With every day that goes by, you can see that medicine is slowly getting the upper hand over the disease.
I think it would have been a great pity if we'd followed the advice of the leader of the opposition and the Labour Party, who said stay in the EU vaccines programme.
At one stage, the EU even threatened to block vaccine exports, a move that would have been likely to hit Britain's imports of vaccines from Pfizer's Belgian plant. But it went back on the threat.
But trust has been eroded, damage has been done, and urgent action is therefore needed.
Doubt was beginning to be cast on the EU's ability to enforce contracts it had agreed on behalf of its members. A row erupted over a contract signed in August between AstraZeneca and the EU Commission. AstraZeneca said it wasn't legally required to deliver doses to the EU on a precise timeline because the contract only stated it would make its best efforts to deliver. Meanwhile, worrying scenes across Europe as vaccination centres delayed or cancelled appointments.
We are mobilised. We are ready to welcome vulnerable people, except that we don't have the vaccine.
The delays risk leaving millions in Europe unprotected deep in the winter, just as new, more transmissible variants circulate and hospitals become overwhelmed.
The problem we're facing in the EU regarding the incapacity of two big companies to deliver the necessary doses at the necessary speed has been a major blow, at least for health workers. Missing these deadlines leaves us at the mercy of the pandemic again for an unknown amount of time.
Reuters reporter Rosanna Pilpot. British television channel BBC World News has been barred from airing in China. The National Radio and Television Administration made the announcement a week after Britain's media regulator revoked China's state-owned CGTN television's broadcast license. The regulatory body said that BBC World News coverage of China had violated requirements that news reporting be true and impartial and undermine China's national interests and ethnic solidarity. The BBC already is generally not viewable in China outside of some hotels, businesses, and residential compounds for foreigners. China's move was condemned by British Foreign Minister Dominic Raab, while the BBC said it was disappointed. And finally, in Africa, as in other developing continents, the desire for economic growth and the need for land and natural resources is often considered to be at odds with the sustainable use of wild lands and their conservation, as well as wildlife. However, in the view of many economic and scientific experts, those two trends can harmonize to the benefit of the economy and the health of the natural world. Now, to find out more about this perspective, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Kadu Sabwe Shibunya, the CEO and president of the African Wildlife Foundation. That happens to be the largest African-led international conservation organization focused exclusively on the continent. Speaking from AWF headquarters in Nairobi, Mr. Shibunya began by stating its mission is to ensure that wildlife and wild lands continue to thrive in modern Africa.
But what is at stake here is the decisions Africa is making around the economic aspirations currently are not factoring in the role of wildlife and wildlands. And a big part of our job is to ensure that wildlife contributes to Africa's aspirations, but also that Africans are aware that it's going to be very hard for us to survive on this continent without the ecological services that are provided by wildlife and wildlands. Africa has over 8,500 protected areas, not only for Africans, but for the global community. It's a reservoir for life.
What are some of the direct benefits that wildlife provides?
Benefits include direct uses like forest products, natural products, traditional medicines, and pharmaceuticals, as well as tourism. But the indirect uses are so many. Water cycles, soil fertility, control of soil erosion, carbon storage, and heritage, wildlife and wildlands for the continent, that is priceless. They define who we are as a continent.
So in your view, what is the single biggest threat to wildlife conservation on the continent?
The biggest threat today is coming from the decisions African leaders are making for our economic development. These next 5 years are going to determine the future of wildlife and wildlands.
What are some of the decisions you're referring to?
Decisions around urbanization, the decisions around consumption, the decisions about our high population, the decision about the choice of transport, the choice of energy, how expansive our food security needs are, or intensive agriculture we invest in, are going to determine the space left for wildlife. Decisions that we make at all levels, whether it's a household level, district level, or national economic development level.
So how do you address the big problem of reconciling the needs of a growing economy and its thirst for more land and more natural resources with the needs of wildlife and the conservation of land?
The problem is the forced choice. At Africa Wildlife Foundation, we believe they have to go together for the ballooning population of Africa. You need water. You need good soil. You need rainfall. 80% of agriculture in Africa is rain-fed. If we don't conserve forests, we won't have rainfall. If we don't have rainfall, we won't have food security. It's as simple as that. Energy sources. If Africa is to industrialize, as our leaders are planning to, you need sustainable energy. Majority of Africa's energy plants are around hydro power generation. In Africa, most of the rivers' origins are from national parks. And we know that these rivers, to be maintained, you need these natural places. You need wildlife. But increasingly, we see decisions that are made are not factoring in what now we call ecological infrastructure for our economic development. They need the roads. They need the housing. They need the health infrastructure. They need agriculture infrastructure. Nobody's talking about the ecological infrastructure that needs to service the other structures.
So in a broad sense, what do you think needs to be done?
What needs to be done? We must all come together as the globe to understand that conservation is not about protecting wildlife animals so that tourists can enjoy them. That's not the point. It's about protecting ourselves from environmental degradation. The biggest priorities right now should be restoring wildlife habitats, planning development activities and infrastructure in such a way that does not compromise environmental well-being.
That's Kadu Sibwe Shabunya, the CEO and president of the African Wildlife Foundation, speaking to my colleague, Adam Phillips. I'm Steve Miller in Washington, and until next time, be well and be safe.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
Under its Rewards for Justice program, the United States is offering a reward of up to $7 million for information leading to the location or identification of Muhammad Abate. Better known as Abd al-Rahman al-Maghrebi, he is based in Iran and is a key leader of Al-Qaeda. Born in Morocco, al-Maghrebi is approximately 51 years old. He is the longtime director of al-Qaeda's media arm, al-Sahab, and is the son-in-law and senior advisor to al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri. Documents recovered from the 2011 military operation against former al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden indicate al-Maghrebi has been a rising star in al-Qaeda for many years. Al-Maghrebi has served as al-Qaeda's general manager in Afghanistan and Pakistan since 2012. Following years of international counterterrorism pressure, he relocated to Iran, where he has continued to oversee al-Qaeda activities worldwide. As head of al-Qaeda's external communications office, al-Maghrebi coordinates activities with al-Qaeda affiliates. The reward for al-Maghrebi is part of the United States' commitment to seeing that al-Qaeda's senior leadership based in Iran faces justice. Since it began in 1984, the Rewards for Justice program has paid in excess of $150 million to more than 100 people who provided actionable information that helped bring terrorists to justice or prevented acts of international terrorism. If you have information on Abd al-Rahman al-Maghrebi, contact the Rewards for Justice office via the website at www.rewardsforjustice.net, email info@rewardsforjustice.net, or mail Rewards for Justice, Washington, D.C., 20530-0303, USA. Individuals may also contact the regional security officer at the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate. All information will be kept strictly confidential.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.